Welcome to This Much I Learn, Marketing Week's regular podcast in which we invite the great and good in marketing and beyond to impart their wisdom and perspective on marketing matters. My name is Russell Parsons, Editor-in-Chief of Marketing Week, and I am your host for this episode. My guest today is Deborah Dolce, Senior Vice President, Group Marketing and Corporate Responsibility Director and Executive Committee Member of TJX Europe, owner of TK Maxx and the HomeSense brands. At this point in my introduction, I would usually list the number of gigs my guest has had at various different marketing organizations, but what's impressive and notable about Deborah's career is that she has had just one employer as a marketer, TJX, and she's been with said employer since the launch of the first TK Maxx store in the UK in 1994, 30 years ago this very month. In an industry where we are constantly being told that tenure is getting shorter, a continuous employment is, if not unique, rare. What has kept her there? And what has she learned from being on the front line at a brand and in a sector that has had to face up to a significant number of challenges over those 30 years? Just some of the questions we will dig into in this podcast. Welcome, Deborah Dolce.
Thank you. Hello.
As I said in my introduction, you've been at the company behind TK Maxx for 30 years. Let me take you back, if I could, to January 1994, when you joined, a time when D-Ream, after my research, topped the chart with Things Can Only Get Better, and Four Weddings and a Funeral launched at the cinema. Describe to me the company you joined then and the role that you had at the time.
Yes, I know. It's a long time ago. It was also the year that Liz Hurley wore the dress with the safety pins for those.
Well, yes, so very much related to the release of Four Weddings and a Funeral. I think she was stepping out, as they used to say, with Hugh Grant at the time.
Exactly right, exactly. Yes, well, so yes, 1994, the retail shopping landscape at that time was very much dominated by department stores and boutiques. I think there might have been the odd factory outlet, I was actually working in agencies at the time, and I was working one evening late in the comms and sort of experiential agency that I worked in, and took a call from somebody in the States describing this amazing concept of off-price, which is what it's called, which is, you know, a big store which sells brands for less and quality for less, with an ever-changing, fascinating, fast-moving, dynamic approach to stock. Merchandise, displaying everything by size, completely different way of shopping. You'd have trolleys and baskets and this extraordinary sort of choice. And that this company, TJX, or TJ Maxx, as it's called in the States, was going to launch in the UK. And it just sounded so different to anything that I'd ever heard of. And we were asked to pitch as an agency to be part of the launch marketing team. Actually, it was actually at the end of 1993. So that was the sort of context of the retail landscape. And it was something that seemed very, very different. And it was a big question in everybody's mind as to whether the British shopper would adopt this concept or not. I'm glad to say they have.
So what was your role when you joined then? How many people did you work with? Give us a sense of that.
So when I joined, there were 40 people, and I was the marketing manager of precisely nothing because we hadn't opened any stores. So in the April of that year, on April 15th, in fact, we opened our first two stores in Bristol and Liverpool. Big stores with, you know, that sort of mix that you people will know from TK Maxx today. So men's, women's, so across all apparel, but also home and gifting and body and bath and luggage and sort of. So it wasn't a classic apparel store, and it wasn't really a department store, and it wasn't. It was just a very unusual concept that we launched.
Mm. So a challenge as a marketer to try and communicate what was a relatively new concept at the time. Talk to me about the process that you went through to determine what the points of difference were.
Yes. Well, as we were launching two stores only, the sort of channel strategy, if it was, would be a very grand way of describing it, was obviously had to be very, very local. because, you know, we had very small budgets and we were really just launching these two stores. I think the really interesting conversations came around whether we should try to sort of educate everybody on the whole off-price concept, which is a much more developed concept in the States. There are other retailers in that space. Or whether we should just come forward with TK Maxx and what we do, which is brands and quality for less. And we opted for the latter. And I think you'll see now, 30 years on, that that sort of expression of off-price still isn't very known. It's not a consumer term. It's very much a trade term. And I think really our focus was just on getting to consumers and educating the customers that could reach one of these two stores. We opened three more later in the year. So we had five in the first year. And, you know, explaining how the model works, because it was so different. This is a business that really relies on a frequency of visit that would be more akin to almost a grocer than a department store, because we change our stock all the time. So it was more putting into customers' minds the concept, its points of difference, and really talking about value. And I think one of the interesting things over the 30 years is that the way in which we express value and, let's say, discounts and savings and deals and bargains, that has really dramatically changed over the 30 years that I've been lucky enough to be in role. At the time, it was really brands for less, and you really couldn't get brands for less in any other way unless you went to a factory outlet where everything was past season. And the whole idea of TK Maxx is that everything isn't past season. The majority of our stock is current season. So it was really calling out the differences. And I think importantly, also helping customers to navigate the store, because it was so different. I mean, now we don't think much about it because lots of stores have, let's say, more like a grocery shopping basket or trolley. But at the time, it was radical. You know, you think about the old-fashioned department stores and the levels of service. So it was more things like explaining to customers that they should shop by department and category and size, because that's how you shop at TK Maxx. Whereas in a department store, you're shopping by concession, by brand. So it was more about calling out the differences and how to get the best out of the concept. So it was really interesting from a marketing point of view, because it was very radical way of turning conventional retail marketing on its head.
I mean, you mentioned there that the way that you communicate value, discounts, deals and bargains, I think they were the four words that you used, has changed over those 30 years. Talk to me about how.
Well, I think obviously the biggest change that we can all experience and see is that customers have a tool in their hands today that they didn't have in 1994 in their little mini computer smartphones. So the sort of checking of prices and values elsewhere, which you can now, I mean, we see this in our own stores, and it's kind of brilliant because we're very proud of what we do and we are very confident about the savings that we offer. But I often see a shop in the store checking, you know, where else is this sold? How much would it cost somewhere else? What would the RRP be? And that sort of level of information that wasn't available then. So in a way, the customer can validate the value for themselves in a completely different way. So that's one big change. But the other big change, as I think that all marketeers know, is the use of the sort of value, whether it's a promotion, a money off, a loss leader, a saving, a discount. I mean, if you walk down the high street today, pretty much every single store's got something about value in their window, in their proposition, in their signage, in their outbound communications, in emails and so forth. And that definitely wasn't the case then, because actually the savvy customer, the smart person who sort of knew how to get better value, it had less kudos than it does today. So we experienced in the early years people proudly shopping in TK Maxx, but proudly not telling anybody that they shopped in TK Maxx. And in fact, I mean, lots of hilarious anecdotes from kind of research groups where people would say, oh, yes, I absolutely shop in TK Maxx, but I pretend it came from a department store. So they weren't so proud about the badge of honor of getting a saving as today. I think people want to be seen as savvy and smart, not, you know, not having the wool pulled over their eyes, not paying over the odds, that's why people, I don't know, buy cars on the continent and import them, or, you know, shop here or shop there. So it's a combination of the choice, the consumer mindset, the pride in being a smart, savvy shopper, and then the sort of competition, which at the time was much more about, I suppose, romancing and luxury, and less about, no, we are the best price. We have the best price. So everything changed.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting what you say there. And I wonder if it was quite as organic as how you've described it. Really interesting what you're saying. I know you didn't use these words, but I interpret it as, you know, almost a people's secret, that they enjoyed the experience, but they didn't want to acknowledge it. And over time, that people have got more at ease with acknowledging the fact that they were seeking out things at lower prices, and weren't afraid to declare that and pass the word around their friends and peer groups. Clearly, that's changed. I've no reason to believe that your insight is wrong there. But you must have facilitated this in some way. So what kind of levers did you pull to make it so that, you know, people not only enjoyed the experience, they were prepared to tell others about it? There must have been something that you and your team have done over those years.
I suppose we've definitely contributed to that conversation, the more national conversation about being smart and savvy. And we always have spoken about no-frills stores. I mean, that's obvious and evident to anybody who's shopped in the TK Maxx. You know, we're having to point out that there's two ways that TK Maxx is able to offer this type of value. One is that we have a completely unique approach to buying, and that we, you know, our buyers are buying all the time and buying what they find in the market, and therefore the stock changes. So we need to explain that to customers, because otherwise the sort of, if you like, treasure hunt or unpredictability of stock isn't really understandable. And the other one is that we're a very smart and efficient business, and we save money in places where others may spend money. So we have consistently pointed out that the stores are no frills, that they're not fancy. You know, we pass the savings back to you, we're running. So I think helping customers to see into the business model and understand the choices that we are making to their advantage, as we would see it, has always been part of our narrative. It's been a brand that's been brilliant from a PR point of view, partly because, well, for a long time, and I obviously remember all these years, at the beginning, let's say the first decade, we were very much the pretender, the outsider. And then maybe only in the last 10 to 15 years, we've become more kind of, I suppose, the reliable, more institutional, you know, that we have 355 TK Maxxes. There's one on every retail park and every high street and then around every corner. So it's more kind of mainstream. But we had the advantage in the early years, which I always think is interesting from a brand and a marketing point of view, of being the kind of slightly maverick outsider, which as a marketeer, I think is actually quite liberating, because you can... You're not trying to be part of the conventions. You're happy to live in your boldness. And I think in some of the creative work that we've always done, we've always embraced that sort of spirit of the business, that it's not the same as everybody else. It's not your everyday kind of conventional offer. And actually, one thing that is interesting is that conventional fashion, and particularly fashion retail marketing, relies heavily on showcasing product, as we all know. So you get like a, you know, this is our spring collection, this is our, you know, now everybody should be wearing polka dots or whatever it might be. But there's no point in doing that for TK Maxx, because the stock changes all the time. It's completely eclectic. So although we do reflect the trends, there's no point me saying to you, you can go and buy that blue shirt, because the chances of you finding it are, you know, quite small. You will find a blue shirt, but I can't tell you which one. And you might also find the copper saucepan and a yoga mat. So actually, as a marketeer, I have found that incredibly liberating, because I'm not trying to show you product. I'm trying to sell you an idea of the business, why you should come to us, what you can find, and also how you'll feel, because you'll feel smart and savvy and you'll have a saving. Of course, you'll have more money. You feel better when you give somebody a gift, you know, because it's a better gift than you could have afforded. So as a marketing team, we've been lucky, because we've been able to focus more on emotions and less on sort of product marketing, because there's nothing for me to market.
And as that evolved over the years, I mean, you're obviously fast forward 30 years, you're clearly a much bigger deal, but you still enjoy success. You're still a compelling proposition. I think in the last financial year, TK Maxx sales were up 17%. So how have you managed, how do you keep topping up that difference? I was really interested in what you were saying there about an idea, that you're selling an idea, but you face a more competitive landscape. You alluded to it earlier. I mean, I think it's probably arguable that nobody has the same operating model, therefore nobody can offer the same proposition and offer necessarily, but you don't have the same room as you did in the category when you launched. So how have you topped up and maintained that point of difference over the years?
Yes, that's definitely true. And there are definitely online operators, particularly, who are obviously a feature of the last part of our history, that are offering brands for less, and plenty of, interesting and good operators. They're much smaller than us, inevitably. But one of the advantages I think we have now, of course, it wouldn't have been true in the early years, is the scale. So, we do actually have hundreds of buyers across the world buying thousands of brands. So I think we've had an advantage in the timing that we launched, just the sort of historical benefit of launching at a time when it was very unique. And now the sophistication of everything from our distribution systems to the way that we know how to operate, that we are in a wonderful position of still being able to bring our customers really exciting product mix. As you say, particularly online, it's not to say that people can't shop around and find other great ways of getting brands for less. And I think latterly, interestingly, obviously with the revival of pre-loved and a sort of more circular model, so the landscape is always changing, but we've had that throughout our history. One of the things that I really like about TK Maxx as a brand, and I think as a marketeer, is a great, I suppose it's a bit of a boon, is that the business does very well. Historically, it's been going in the US for over 45 years, in both times of tighter belts and cost of living and recession, as well as times of, greater affluence. Because ultimately, everybody loves a bargain, and you can get brands for less. And that still stands as a very sort of solid truth. So it has a lot of elasticity as a model. And as a result, we are dialing up and down some small messages, but fundamentally, the core of the proposition is always the same. Basically, it's brands and quality and fashion for less, with a constant choice and change. By the way, it's not for everybody. I mean, we're not naive. It's not Marmite, but there are a lot of people that find the shopping experience in TK Maxx tricky. So one of the things that, I'm lucky enough to run in my team, or to oversee, I should say, is the store experience. We're always trying to evolve the shopping experience and make sure it's relevant and modern and easy to shop. And I know people will be throwing their rubbers at the screen and saying it's not easy to shop, but we're trying to make it as easy to shop as possible all the time. And again, that's something that's radically changed over the years. How stores themselves, the shopping experience itself. And I think the brilliant thing about being a retailer, for everybody who's a retail marketeer, is of course you have this direct connection to your customers in your stores all the time, every day. So outside of your classic marketing channels, you actually have your stores. You're not one step removed like a FMCG marketeer is. And we're close to our customers. We talk to them, listen to them, hear them. I mean, literally standing in the store, you learn so much from listening to customers in the stores. But you have that kind of extra playground, 355 stores of places where I can get a message to a customer if I want to. So that's also another exciting, for me. And it's funny, isn't it? Because in the 30 years, I think retail itself as a category has grown in cachet. Maybe that's my perception, but I don't know. I mean, retail was never the sort of the cool kid, was it? It was the, trading kind of place. And, especially actually in marketing terms, I think retail marketeers weren't necessarily in the heart of the marketing community, as I believe they are today.
Well, I suppose people do look for best practice, often in sectors like consumer goods, for example. I'm not the right person to judge whether or not retail marketing is less or more sexy than it's ever been, or has more cachet, sorry to use your word, than it ever has?
Well, I mean, obviously, grocers, you know, there's a lot of brilliant marketeers in the grocery sector, the retail grocery sector. But, you know, historically, I think retail marketeers were viewed, I'm talking, you know, 30, 40 years ago, as a little bit of a service to the business. Whereas I think all of us now understand that marketeers, the marketeers are, you know, the champions of the customer, that, you know, this customer behaviors, the channels, the ways that we reach customers. You know, we've all got loyalty programs, we've got sort of, you know, data programs. So the, and again, the grocers very much started that, didn't they, as a marketing route. But, you know, that it's a kind of really quite interesting, sophisticated marketing model that you have. Plus, I say, this amazing advantage of having your very own playground.
Just changing tack slightly, I appreciate this is going to probably cause you to wince, but I'm quoting you from LinkedIn, by the way, your own profile. There is reason. It's not just to embarrass you. You talk about the extensive experience of change management and leading teams through transformation for growth. And I pulled that, as I say, not just to make you perhaps wince at your own words, but just to demonstrate the fact that in those 30 years, retail has seen a lot of changes. I mean, all business has, but retail, particularly at the coalface of changes in consumer behavior, some of which we've touched on, has meant a lot of change to manage. But what excites you about what's next, both for your employer and for retail? And indeed, what headwinds perhaps keep you awake? Let's start with what excites you. Let's start with the positive first.
Yes, when I'm talking about that change management, of course, I'm also thinking about the growth of TK Maxx, as we've discussed, from, you know, 5 stores in the UK, you know, now to, you know, I don't know, we employ over 40,000 people across Europe in 6 markets. We have 2 brands, which we, because we have HomeSense, our other brand. We've all launched online. Everybody in retail pretty much has launched a version of being online, or nearly every retailer, a couple that haven't. So, you know, those are the types of changes, because you have to then think about the team and what skills do you need in the team. And what, I mean, my team is, honestly, Russell, in the early years, you were literally, in 1994, what could you do? You could do a door drop. You could run a local press ad. You could run some radio. We didn't have enough money to run TV anyway for the, easily the first 10 years. I don't think I could afford to even make a TV ad. And now we've got social media and influencers and the role of earned media and, you know, the data scientists and analytics that we've talked about. So the actual construct of the team is also very different, as well as, you know, holding that sort of traditional campaign and creative and media, you know, what we knew. So that's what I mean by change, responding both to the landscape but also to the marketing needs, so sort of on two fronts. But in terms of what's exciting, I mean, I think, you know, we've all been talking about media fragmentation for the longest time, but just how we get to customers and also what customers really care about, you know, what's relevant to them. There's so much choice and in terms of how they receive and digest and engage with brands, and being choiceful and intentional about that, I still think is really exciting. And there are, I'm not even, it could be anything from gamification to social commerce to, you know, particularly some of the technology driven, I suppose, marketing innovations that we might see. I still really believe in building a strong brand. I also think the role of trust and purpose is really interesting for business. It's obviously, again, something very well documented. But in this world of, you know, transparency and greater disclosure and more kind of visibility of how a business is. And I think we really saw that in the pandemic. You know, the businesses that treated their staff well and businesses that didn't, you know, was very visible in the press. It was reported, it was talked about. But we haven't yet seen such a shift. We see it partially, don't we, that of customers acting on some of those imperatives. So I think you have a core of customers that really live their values very strongly, and will make purchasing decisions based on their convictions and their ethics. But I believe there's more of that to come. I think people will make choices based on what they know about a business. So I still think there's more to come in that space. And that's quite interesting for brand people, because, you know, historically you would have, you know, again, 30 years ago, perhaps you were more describing your business and what you want people to take out. And now you're actually needing to be in more of a dialogue with people and understand what they want to hear about and what matters to them and what's important and how will they make their decisions and what do they trust and how honourable are you and how all of those aspects, I think, to marketing have grown.
As we've talked about, that people are making decisions on the basis of the fact that you're offering good value. Do you genuinely believe that people will also factor in how you behave and how you face the world and what your values are? You could probably tell by my question that I'm slightly skeptical about this. There's a lot of studies out there that say people do make decisions on that basis, but there's also what people say and what they actually do.
Yeah. I mean, obviously this is a question of sort of personal conviction. I'm perfectly aware of the say-do gap, absolutely. And I think that's very live and well. And there are different dynamics in play at different times. At the moment in the UK, where we have, you know, a cost of living type of pressure on customers, some people will change the order of their priorities. You know, right now, people are really looking for value. It's people need to make their money stretch as far as possible, and they may forego some other things that they consider important. But there might be other times when they can allow themselves or can afford to change that order again. I believe in a climate of a lot of competition and a lot of information that customers have multiple reasons with which they can make a decision to choose a brand or, to shop a store. And for some customers, those things will be important. To what degree? And I understand the thinly veiled skepticism, Russell. But I just think if you need a decision, if you're faced with two, let's say you're faced with a company with which offers exactly the same product, and you know one of them treats its staff well and sources ethically and one doesn't, and you know and you have that information, you have a choice to make. Obviously, there's still always going to be price, there's going to be quality of product, there's going to be choice, there's going to be service. So all of the other factors remain. I feel this is just a new additional consideration for customers. But you're right, we haven't seen it play out. But we have seen some companies be, I was going to say punished, it's a bit hardcore, but, you know, having a little bit more scrutiny. But it does come in waves and troughs. I mean, I think, you know, it does depend contextually on the environment, the more sort of macroeconomic climate, and in some cases.
Skepticism, I suppose, from a journalistic perspective, is healthy. Because if I reflect on my own behaviour, there are certain brands, because of stories that I've read about the behaviour of their executive, whatever it is, that I just don't buy anymore. I don't consider myself particularly values-driven or principled. It's just that I took issue with an action, and therefore that brand is off limits for me. But equally, I pick and choose the things that I decide to care about as well. And if somebody's offering me something of great value, then I might perhaps conveniently forget any reputational challenge that previously faced. So clearly I'm all over the place. So let's move on.
A fair weather customer, that's fine. No, but I mean, that's the point, isn't it? It depends on the moment in time and your mindset and your financial situation and so forth. I just think that the days of a business sort of doing its work behind closed doors, that's definitely gone. We all know that. I mean, I think a good business stands by its values, it lives them fully internally and externally, and it's prepared to share them. One of the things that I love about TK Maxx is the democracy of the business. It's one of the things that's kept me here a long time, because I love the fact that the business serves such a wide range of customers, all customers of all ages. We're equally shopped, young and old, and I love the fact that in retail, you know, people who come from all sorts of different backgrounds can have all sorts of different careers. And that's, I think, one of the things that's quite special about retail. It's you know, very sort of, and now everybody wants to talk about inclusion, diversity and openness, but it's actually inherent in the retail business, because that's how people, you know, the store teams are held in great esteem. I mean, running a TK Maxx store is really a really, really complicated job. I mean, I was chatting to the store manager of the Oxford Street store recently. You know, he takes multiple deliveries a day. He's got huge stock flowing through. You know, whole chunks of the stock will change week to week. He's got massive store teams. He's got big peaks and troughs. I mean, he runs bigger teams than half the people in head office. So, you know, they're really complex jobs. I really like that about retail. It's really very a very democratic sector.
I was going to ask you, and it seems like an appropriate time to pose the question, what's kept you at the same company for so long? You've just alluded to one reason. What are others? Because it, you know, it is unusual, perhaps. Maybe I'm bringing a lot of assumptions to that assertion that it is unusual, but perhaps increasingly so, to stay at a company for as long as you have. What's kept you there?
I think it is unusual, because when I tell people, they normally look really shocked. So yes, I don't think it is that common. Hopefully it's not just that I'm not very imaginative and can't think of anywhere else to work. It's much more than that. There are two things, really. One is that I really love the business model. I genuinely think it's a brilliant idea. I kind of wish I'd invented it. It's just such a good idea. To buy in season and buy stock in this very wide and eclectic way, and therefore be able to bring things to customers for less. That kind of matches my own values. I like the kind of normalness and savviness of that. So I really like the model. I really, really like the culture. And that wasn't something that I necessarily knew about before I joined the business, what kind of culture would suit me. But I've had lots of different roles in the business. I've had loads of opportunities. I've been in and out of marketing. Perhaps I've come back to my sort of, you know, my core love in the end. But it's just been a really brilliant business to be in. And when I'm talking to people, you know, sort of my own kids or their friends and family about, it's such an alien concept when you enter the workplace to think about the culture of a business. I don't think you think about it at all. You think about what kind of job you'd like and what kind of brand or company you'd like to work for. But I always say to, you know, anybody that I'm chatting to, try and find out about the culture of the business, because it's not good or bad, but there are things that are different. Some businesses are very flat. Some businesses you might really get, you know, rewarded for striking out on your own. That would definitely not be the case in our business. So it's more about matching to you where you will thrive. So I just think I've been lucky to land somewhere that suits me and my preferred way of working and values. So that has definitely been what's kept me here for a long time. And you asked earlier what's exciting. I still think there's loads to do. You know, there's loads of exciting things that are still coming at us. Different ways that people shop, different ways that people choose to engage with brands. You know that I also run corporate responsibility and sustainability. So I've been lucky to also add other remits over the years, which of course is intellectually stimulating. I can't say I've ever had a boring day.
I suppose that's the nature of the category that you work in. And if you have been kept interested by taking on additional responsibilities, moving sideways as you have and as you've just described. And the reason I point it out is because we hear all the time the study after study about the lower tenure for marketers. And I said in my introduction that it is notable. It shouldn't perhaps be, but it is notable the fact that you've worked at the same company broadly in marketing over that period of time. Forgive me, I don't mean to ask you to justify yourself. There must be some advantages to consistency. There has to be advantages to consistency, a long tenure, because, well, chopping and changing doesn't generally lead to improved outcomes. Is that something that you recognize, that there is a value to that consistency?
I mean, I do believe that there's an advantage. Of course, I would say that, wouldn't I? I suppose,
it's difficult. I'm asking you to step outside yourself and think about the problems that chopping, changing, and having a constant changing is at the top of the marketing tree.
Well, I think if I go the other way around, the benefit of the change would be the freshness. So if I can have both the continuity and the freshness, then I think that that would put us in a very strong position. So in the exec group that I sit in, three of us have been there 30 years. Several people have been there more than 20. And the youngest are kind of 12 or 13 years. So we're very tight as a team. We're able to work really close. And I have a lot of people in my own team who've been, you know, I mean, one of the people in my team is the second person I ever employed in 1994. So that we do have a lot of tenure. And the advantage of the tenure is the consistency. It's the deep knowledge of the business, knowing how to get things done, being able to be agile, being quick, really understanding the model, our business model. So those are the advantages and taking all of the learnings. The disadvantage would be becoming complacent, getting used to what you do, knowing what you know. So I think the challenge, if you're in a position for a long time, is to remain fresh and outward looking, which is something that we all talk about, you know, a lot, because you have to be intentional about that, don't you? So you have to go and look for that outside learning. Obviously, you can get a lot of it through your agencies. You can get it from going to conferences. You can get it through your own nous of what we call comp shopping, which is, you know, just wandering around looking at shops. That's part of the job when you're in retail. So I think staying fresh, looking outside of the sector, I think that's really important, you know, so that you don't become kind of clouded by what you think you know. Then I think you have the best of both worlds. What wouldn't be good would be to be doing the job in the same way that I was doing it. And I would really be trying really hard not ever to say, yeah, I've done that, tried that, didn't work. Because times change and things are different. So even those, it's, you know, sometimes things do come round again and they're better the second time or the third time, or of course something new happens. So I think there's an advantage in, and actually from an actual brand proposition point of view, some of our sort of core hallmarks, our actual branding identity, our, you know, our big label small prices, which we've had for years and years and years. I think you see this in other sectors as well, where people have rigorously stood by their original platforms, and of course changed campaigns that support them, rather than having a whole new team coming in, throwing everything out. Again, multiple case studies of that isn't helpful. I think continuity from a brand point of view, in terms of customer recognition and perception, is actually helpful. So hopefully the best of both worlds.
And how have you kept yourself interested and maintained motivation over that period of time? What are your key tips to others, perhaps, who feel the need to do the same?
Well, I've been lucky because the business itself has grown. So every time I feel like I've just about managed to master my job, something new happens. We'll open in a new country. We'll open a new channel. We'll open a different brand. We'll, you know, face a different external challenge. So that's nothing to do with me. I've been lucky to be in that environment. I have tried really hard over the years to be very, as I said earlier, intentional about looking outside of both my own business, but also the sector. In more recent years, because I have three sons, and in the more recent years, I've had a little bit more capacity from a time point of view. I've taken a couple of pro bono roles, and they are really interesting because they're in completely different sectors. One's in charity and one's in arts and culture. And the learning, of course, it's two-way. You know, it's not, they're nothing like the sector that I work in, but there is always something, a little idea, a germ of something, a provocation that can come from that. I think mentoring is really interesting. I really believe in reverse mentoring. I'm quite active in the Marketing Academy, as I think you know, and they've got some reverse mentoring going on, but also I've been a mentor right since it launched. And actually, that's really interesting. Hopefully, I'm able to give something of value to the people I'm talking to. But, you know, they're talking about their businesses, and that exchange of knowledge is always useful. But just being deliberate about it. Next week, I'm going to World Retail Congress. I'm sure I'll take thousands of pages of notes, and then I'll have to work out which three of the things that I think are brilliant ideas could I possibly apply to my own business. It's just not allowing yourself to be, I suppose, boring. It's probably the best way I can say.
That's good life advice. Avoid being boring. I think we'll get us not only through our professional lives, but our personal lives as well.
And actually, no, one practical thing, I think it is really quite funny. I was just last night, it's also who you talk to and your peer group. So having peer groups, both in and outside of your sector and industry, but also just other, I mean, marketing is just, so in it's just everywhere, isn't it? It's in everybody's life. So last night, I was at dinner with having dinner with two of my sons and their two of my sons and their girlfriends, and we were talking about social commerce, I was interested in D2C beauty because obviously that's a huge thing, and I was really quizzing them. I think they probably think I'm a bit weird, but I was like, But would you do that? Would you actually dial into a live shopping session and then buy something because an influencer said, hey, look at this eyeliner? And they were like, yeah, we would do that. And I was like, oh my goodness, I really need to like... So of course, I'm going to immediately try and sign up for that.
You've got to use your focus groups as they present themselves to you. Now,
teenagers.
Indeed. Well, you know what? I have a 12-year-old, almost 13, and she's technically too young to be on TikTok, but is on there all the time. Bad parenting, perhaps, but I'm fascinated by her interaction and engagement with and the cues for engagement with brands as well. It's a world, I think, that I, as a parent, need to be aware of, but even more so as marketers. And that brings me on. It wasn't meant to be a segue. It's a less than seamless one. But
you're going to suggest that I should retire because I'm so old.
No, absolutely not. 100% no. That's not what I was going to say. I was going to still talk about, you talked about the plethora of channels that are now available compared with what was available when you started in 94, and you know, the explosion in data. So there's been a lot of change in marketing, a lot more options available in marketing in that time. If I could ask you just to identify one thing that you think has changed for the better in marketing over your tenure, what would they be?
Well, all the things that are coming to my head for better are all controversial, Russell. I have a lot of passion, and it's probably because it's where I started my career, for what used to be called PR or comms. And I still really believe that an integrated marketing approach has a strong comms idea at the heart of it. So I like the fact that the disciplines in marketing perhaps sit at a more equitable table today than they did in the 90s, where advertising was king. And I think media also has changed its role and grown and also sits at that table in a different way. So I like the kind of democratization, I suppose, of the disciplines in marketing, because I think that means you choose truly the best ideas and the best channels and the best content. So that's something that I think's I prefer.
One final question, if I could, and I'd ask you to be as concise as you possibly can be. If there's one piece of advice, the name of this podcast is This Much I Learned. So if there's one thing that you've learned in your career, your successful career to date, that you think could benefit others, what advice would you impart?
Stay fresh, keep yourself learning, outward looking, curious, and modern.
Fresh, curious, and modern. Again, I would suggest good life advice. Never mind as a as an aspiring marketing leader. That seems like a really nice moment to finish on. Thank you, Deborah, for your time and taking us through that 30-year journey at TK Maxx and as a marketer.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to This Much I Learn with me, Russell Parsons, produced by Georgia Chantrell Plant and edited by Mihai Andrei. You can listen to previous episodes of This Much I Learn on Apple or Spotify podcasts or wherever you get them. Until next time, goodbye.